This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is Cindy Shepherd, and we're going to be talking about a rather odd title, The Preacher as Minor Poet. Now, Cindy, where does that come from?
That comes from T.S. Eliot, who is a major poet, but he wrote once that all communities need not only their major poets, but minor poets as well to help them interpret their lives.
And you recently attended a seminar in Michigan, was it?
Yes, in Grand Rapids at Calvin College.
And it had that. The seminar had that title, the Preacher as Minor Poet. Now, you are do you call yourself a minister, a pastor, or a preacher? What do you call yourself in your denomination?
A pastor.
But you do preaching.
Yes.
And in the South, when I lived in North Carolina for a dozen years, all Protestant ministers and some priests were called preachers.
It's been hard enough to get used to Pastor Cindy. I'm not sure Preacher Cindy would.
But you do preach. You even preached this morning, you were telling me earlier. You preach regularly at the Philo Presbyterian Church near Champaign-Urbana. You're the pastor there.
Yes.
And how long have you been there?
I've been there 5 years now.
Okay. And in your preaching role, how do you think about being a preacher? How do you think of what to say on a Sunday morning, since part of that service every week is people being quiet and listening to just you talk?
It's probably the only 20 minutes that I can be sure that people are going to listen to me, so I love that 20 minutes. But I don't think that you ever run out of sermon material, because in our tradition you preach from the Bible, so every week you have a text that you look at and study and try to interpret and bring to people in a way that it will impact their lives. And this seminar was talked a lot about the intersection between the text and the congregation, and you try to find something to say in the crossroads there between what the Bible says and what the people are saying to you.
Now, all kinds of people are telling us what the Bible says, some of them in quite strident voices, in letters to the editor, on other radio stations. How do you determine, as someone who's trying to interpret that biblical text, what it does say?
That's a good question. We talked a lot this last week about how we learned in seminary to do it and how we do it as a matter of practice, and it's somewhat different maybe. And in seminary, you learn to look at the historical context and the literary context and try and figure out what the writer was trying to say to God's people at the time that it was written, and then figure out if that is something that needs to be said to God's people right now.
Hmm.
I don't guess I've gotten too far from that.
And when you were at this seminar, tell us a little bit about it. Who led it? How did you happen to go? How long was it? That sort of thing.
It lasted a week, and it was led by Craig Barnes, who is he's teaching at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, which is a Presbyterian school, and is also the pastor of Shadyside Presbyterian Church, which I guess is one of the old Presbyterian churches there in Pittsburgh. He was at the National Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. until just a few years ago, I think. And I realized after I had applied for the seminar that he and I graduated from Princeton in the same year, but we did not know each other when we were in seminary.
So you went to Princeton Theological Seminary in New Jersey. That's a 3-year program.
Right.
And you get a master's in divinity.
A master's of divinity.
And that's after 4 years of college. What was your college experience?
I went to the University of Kansas.
Okay. Did you grow up in Kansas?
I did.
Where?
I was in western Kansas till I was about 10, and then my family moved to Topeka, the capital. We blew in the same time as a big Topeka tornado. So.
And did you grow up in a religious household? Is that how you ended up becoming a minister, going to seminary? How did that all happen?
I did grow up in a, yes, in a religious household and very mainstream Presbyterian, go to Sunday school and church every Sunday and have family devotions and that sort of thing. And so I kind of grew up in that environment and knowing how important my faith was to me. So when I went to college and majored in English and philosophy, then I was looking for what I was going to do with my life. And I thought, well, I could go to law school, I could go to seminary, and I would much prefer the life of a preacher.
So you were studying philosophy as well as English literature in University of Kansas and chose to go to seminary. Did you apply to more than one or just Princeton?
I just applied to Princeton. Hmm. The pastor that I looked up to most when I was growing up was from Princeton, and I just thought that was the place to go. So, mm-hmm.
And was that a good experience for you?
It was an interesting experience for me, yeah. I'd never been out east, and I went to seminary years and years and years ago, and there weren't very many women there. And so it was interesting and difficult.
Both.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And most of the professors at that time were probably also male.
Oh, yes.
Did you have any female professors?
I did. I had a Christian education, Frieda Gardner, and pastoral care. I had and then one Old Testament professor was a woman, but I didn't take any classes from her. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that she was there, she came to women's meetings and was inspirational.
Mm-hmm. How many other women would have been in your class typically?
I think about 10% of us were okay. Women then, so uh-huh. There were some.
Uh-huh. What year, if you don't mind saying, did you graduate?
I graduated in 81.
81, all right. So there's been a huge change in the last 20 years.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. In most seminaries, I think the majority of the students are women now. At Princeton, it's probably half.
And probably half the faculty are women, or close to it.
I don't know, but probably. Cynthia Campbell's the president of McCormick, and she was a pastor in Kansas when I was there. So.
First woman mm-hmm. president of a Presbyterian seminary.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Now, how did you get from seminary to your concept of preaching now? What's changed over that amount of time? You say you still, of course, deal with a biblical text. You try to interpret that text for the people that you mm-hmm. know are going to be in your congregation that day. But how has your mind changed, if any?
Well, when you graduate from seminary, you know everything. Hmm. And so I've gotten a lot less sure about things over the years, a lot less sure about what people need to hear. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, I think in any profession, but especially in one where you're a part of people's lives, you grow more humble over the years. And I hope that's happened for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about what you learned in this recent seminar. But before we get specifically into it, As a Protestant minister, a Presbyterian minister specifically, you're expected to do continuing education regularly. In fact, it's part of the arrangement you have with the congregation that you get a certain amount of time off each year. There's a certain amount of money available mm-hmm. to do this kind of thing. So that's what this experience was, a chance for you to keep your intellectual life going.
Right.
And how did it go?
It was wonderful. I really had a great week. I think I learned a lot, and we read some wonderful books before we went, which were some of them were religious and some of them were not, but they were all about writing and poetry, and so that was a great experience. I do a lot of wonderful things with the congregation that I value very highly, but we don't have a book group where we mm-hmm. just read a good book and talk about it. And so that was a lot of fun. I read Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, which is a great book. Just like sitting down with a new best friend. And The Writing Life by Annie Dillard. Now, Anne Lamott's book made me think I should write a book. And while I was reading her book, I sat down and started a book. Then Annie Dillard's book starts out, whatever you've written, you should tear up and throw away. So I read them in that order. And we read a Brueggemann book, which was the more theological book, Finally Comes the Poet. And let's see. Oh, The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene. And the last book, I'm having trouble thinking of the name of it. But it was about a pastor in a small rural congregation in Minnesota. And we read that as an example of exegesis of a congregation.
All right. Now you need to help some of our listeners know what exegesis means.
Doesn't it mean reading the meaning out of something, getting the meaning out of it, and kind of the meaning behind the meaning. People will tell you what the meaning of their life is, but you have to look at how they live over a period of time before you really figure it out.
Now, usually that word is used in terms of literature, a book or a writing. You exegete, get the meaning out of mm-hmm. that writing, but you're using it, and apparently it was used in this class as a way to also get the meaning out of a group of people, mm-hmm. a congregation. Tell us more about that.
That was Craig Barnes' idea of how you bring the text to people and people to the text, that you do want to look and see what the significant relationships are and how they treat one another over time, how much a part of a mass consumer culture a particular community is. And some communities are completely consumed by a mass culture. Some of the preachers that were at this seminar were in serving congregations in California, not to pick on California, but
oh, go ahead.
or suburban Chicago, or places where their people are living lives that are very, very foreign to me. Driving 4 hours a day to get to a job so that you can support a lifestyle that is almost unimaginably opulent to me.
I see. How many people were in the seminar?
There were 15 of us.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Cindy Shepherd, who's the pastor at the Philo Presbyterian Church near Champaign-Urbana in the center of Illinois.
And the universe.
That's true. It says so right on the water tower, center of the universe. We're talking about a recent experience she had at a seminar at Calvin College in Michigan, a seminar titled The Preacher as Minor Poet. We're eager to have listeners join our conversation with a comment or question. You can do that by phone in Champaign-Urbana. Punch in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else the program can be heard, including on the Internet, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So, 800-222-WILL is a free call anywhere in the continental U.S. And I see we have a caller waiting. Let's go to line number one, a local line. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi, and thanks, Cindy, for what you do. I disagree with the fact that the preacher is a minor poet, because I've known many, many major poets who are preachers. Anyhow, that's beside the point. My question is this. I'm a nurse. I don't practice nursing. I graduated almost 50 years ago. I don't practice nursing the same way now as I did then. Would it be like taking textbooks that I used to use? Do you update your response to preaching? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air. Do you understand?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Thanks.
That yes, so continuing education is one way that we do try to keep abreast of new ideas. when you're dealing with an ancient text like the Bible, you think, well, there's nothing really new that's going to come out of that. That it's not like medicine where or nursing where techniques that change over time and science advances in that way. And yet, there are fresh perspectives that are brought to it, and there are new things about the text or new ways of looking at the text that make you able to do a better job today, I think. And this seminar was one of my attempts to do that.
For me, looking back, I was in seminary even much before you. But as I look back on the changes since I was graduated from seminary in 1969, the advances in biblical studies is really what I guess has impressed me and what I've had to work hard to sort of keep reading on to learn how all the new knowledge that's available. In terms of Christian theology, some of the great thinkers from many centuries ago are still as relevant as ever. But in terms of interpreting the Bible, it seems like we really have had some great advances because of knowledge of the ancient languages that we've learned and the history of the ancient times through archaeology and other methods, as well as just the analysis of the Bible as literature. We've just learned so much more about the forms that are in the Bible and what they meant at the time and what they mean now. And that's been continually exciting to me to try to keep up with at least a little bit. What are the things that you've noticed in 20 years or so? Anything in particular that you preach different now than you did when you first came out of seminary?
Oh, I don't think in seminary I'd read about the ancient cultures and I think Jesus parables especially. I seem much fresher and more wonderful to me since I read that. Is it Kenneth Bailey that did all that work?
In the Middle East, right.
Yeah.
Understanding Middle Eastern culture and how that informed how we often miss what's in some of the parables. When you went to the seminar, Cindy, and you've talked about what you were reading, this seems like an odd list to me. You have things by two writers, Annie Dillard and Annie Lamont, about the writing process, Bird by Bird and the Writing Life. What was the professor, Craig Barnes, trying to get ministers who are there to do? Be better writers of
yes.
sermons? Really?
Yes.
Yeah. Good.
I think for some of the people, we weren't all Presbyterian, and for some of the people there to think of themselves as writers was a really new idea, and they were thrilled with the books about writing and just about observing. Writing as observation and making sense of things was a new thought for them. So those were neat.
And a novel, Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory. Why was a novel selected? Why fiction for pastors?
We read it for the way it conveyed the truth of somebody's soul. The main character, as you remember, is a whiskey priest in Mexico during a time when his district in Mexico had outlawed Catholicism. And so he was on the run. But as he was on the run from the law, he came to realizations about his own souls, and it was a beautiful book. It's a real tragedy of a story because he seems to come to understand himself too late. And yet there's some – the way that Graham Greene understands his character and soul was wonderful. We talked in that session. We talked about altar burn, which was a new expression for me. Do you know what that means?
No.
Dr. Barnes told us that it's used a lot in Roman Catholic clergy circles, that and that they refer to altar burn as what happens when you handle holy things so much that you forget that they're holy, and then they burn you. The priest in the novel tries to give communion, tries to continue to serve Mass or hold Mass. What do you do with Mass?
I think you offer the Mass.
Maybe. He offers the Mass, and yet he's lost his own faith.
And then one of the other books you read was Finally Comes the Poet.
Yes. That was the most theological of the offerings. And that talks about how people who proclaim God's word now and are talking to people who are either living on the surface by avoiding two extremes. I think a numbness and ache was one of the... He sets up these four dichotomies that he thinks that a preacher needs to address in modern culture. And so that was the most difficult reading. But it was interesting, too. He's an Old Testament scholar, and so he used a lot of Old Testament texts and the poetry of the Old Testament to address these contemporary concerns. That was interesting.
This is Walter Brueggemann, Old Testament expert. Was at Eden Seminary, and now is at Columbia, I think, if I remember right.
That sounds right to me,
and
Columbia.
And the author of many books and a teacher of many preachers, professor of seminary students. Again, we're talking with Cindy Shepherd about The Preacher as Minor Poet, trying to bring the text, the biblical text, to congregations in many different settings these days. Ministers find themselves sort of in different subcultures as they move from church to church and trying to interpret the Bible for the people who are hearing them on a given Sunday has been a growing challenge. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. There are several local lines you can access by punching in 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455 is our toll-free line for folks farther away. Cindy, when you came back from this seminar, you had to preach this last Sunday. This was your first sermon after the seminar. Did that week of continuing education affect how you prepared?
It did. It did. One of the things that we learned was when we read a text and after we do the research on it, to look for, he called them portals in the text, that not necessarily what the key verse was for the in the terms of the biblical argument or something, but a portal that would lead you into the deeper meaning for people's lives. And so I tried that this week. I don't know how successful it was, but it felt a little different.
So as a Protestant pastor who follows the lectionary, the selection of biblical text, one gospel, one epistle or letter, one Old Testament or Hebrew Bible passage, one psalm, you have four passages available sort of for each Sunday. How did you pick which one to concentrate on for this Sunday, this morning?
Because I'm at my fifth year in Philo, I'm going through the lectionary the second time, and so I'm mostly...
It's a three-year cycle.
Three-year cycle. So I'm mostly picking the ones I didn't pick the first time through. So I had preached last year on the rich fool, which was the gospel passage. And so this year I picked the Hosea passage from the Old Testament.
And what's it about?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful piece of poetry in which God agonizes over what he's going to do about his people who have run away from him. And it pictures God as this doting parent that's raised a baby. And it says, I was like, I lifted the baby to my cheek. And that's how it pictures the relationship between God and God's people. And now they're running away and they're doing all this sinful stuff, and what's he going to do about it? And I chose as my portal where he says, I hold you with cords of human kindness and bands of love. And so I gave everybody a piece of rope to hang on to during this sermon.
Something tactile. Now, you referred to God as he, and yet the image of holding a baby can be a very maternal image. How do you deal with the gender of the divine?
Well, I try to use both. And I probably, in this passage, it is a more feminine image. It is a mother image, and the actions are more of what a mother would do in raising a baby. Hosea is full of interesting feminine images.
We have a caller waiting. Let's go to line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Hi, it's me again. I have two questions, though. I love Hosea, by the way, and most people don't even know where to find it. And that includes me. One question is, do you think you're jaded? You talked about being numb and aching and all that stuff. Do you think a preacher gets jaded? The second question is, do you make home visits? I have a personal and a professional reason for asking that, because I think it's very important to be visited in the home if you're sick. And I'll hang up and listen to you off the air. Thanks.
So the first question was, do preachers get jaded?
I think that's a danger in any profession, and for preachers too. I think that's part of what that expression altar burn is about, that you can begin to take for granted the sacredness of people's lives, and so that can happen. I think you have to be careful and humble not to let it happen, and to watch out when it does and back off. And one of the ways that I think helps me avoid it is to visit people where they live, and visit people in their homes or in their workplaces. And I'm amazed at the lives that people lead. I'm amazed at the courage that a lot of people have to exhibit just to get through the day. And when you see that, it's hard to be cynical about that.
Now, it used to be that doctors would make home visits. It doesn't happen much anymore. Are ministers, priests, rabbis the only folks that really do that?
Well, nurses do it.
Ah, okay.
And our church has a parish nurse, mm-hmm. and that's kind of part of her calling, part of her ministry.
What do you do when you visit a home? Do you call and let them know you're coming?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So no surprise visit.
No, I don't just show up at the door. But yes, I try to visit everyone in my congregation. I have a very small congregation, so I think I've been in everyone's home. Mm-hmm. Just because when you are in someone's home and their environment, you get a little better feel for what their life is like. You can picture them going about their business and making the decisions and raising the kids. Mm-hmm. So that helps me to feel closer to them. And then I try to visit when people are having difficulties.
Mm-hmm. If they're sick.
Illness
or, there's been a death.
Yes, problems.
And are people nervous when the minister shows up to their home?
No, I'm the one that's nervous. Mm. No, I don't think people are. I try not to make people nervous. Mm-hmm. Do you think people are nervous?
Oh, I think some people are. I think some people are afraid. Are they going to make me pray? Are they going to, you know?
You know, I usually offer people. I would like to pray with people, and I make that invitation. But I've had people turn me down. Mm-hmm. So it's just,
that's fine.
It's a yes or no question. Mm-hmm. I can hear no too.
We're about halfway through our program this week with Cindy Shepherd, pastor of the Philo Presbyterian Church. We're talking about the preacher as minor poet, bringing together text and congregation. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this Keeping the Faith program that's on WILL AM 580 every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time. It says a live call-in program, and we're eager to have folks ask questions or make comments. 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Coming up next week, Danny Otto will be our guest on Keeping the Faith. We'll be talking about the Amish relief sale. The Amish are a very interesting group of religious folks that are located several places in the Midwest, including in Arthur, Illinois. We'll be also have a real opportunity in talking to Danny Otto because, of course, most people know the Amish avoid some modern things like radio and television. But Danny Otto has been a guest here once before, and will be on next week. Father Paul Pluth will be talking about Mary in church life on August 15. Joel and Barry Schweitzer will be our guests August 22nd, talking about Jewish education. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. Hope you can listen. A guest earlier in the month of July, Jeannie Murray Walker, who is a poet, has given us permission to read some of her poetry from time to time on this program. And since we're talking about the preacher as minor poet, I thought we'd have a practicing published poet and professor again this week. And a short poem I'm going to read is called Wee Hours. This is part of her collection, A Deed to the Light, published by the University of Illinois Press and edited by Lawrence Lieberman as part of the Illinois Poetry Series. Here's a poem called Wee Hours by Jean Murray Walker. It begins with a quotation from Roger Angel. How innocent we were back then, last Monday. You wake uneasy to the fleet wind rattling your door, your mind scrambling for what? Not this slip and blab of raindrops, not the bell tolling, the towers again? A sniper, this time a child maybe at the trigger. With a shudder, your old life turns sideways and slips behind the wind, throwing the moon off balance. You're practicing pain, rousing the lion of terror, so when it turns the corner and eats your heart, you won't be caught off guard. When it will find you, can't be counted on. Only a few things can be counted on: the sun, the old sun rising, the grass growing, the same sky doling out the same blue, and children shaking out their petals in the schoolyard every day, even that day. Wee Hours, a poem by Jean Murray Walker. These Keeping the Faith programs are provided and supported in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the university. It was started by students 131 years ago, and since that time has been providing opportunities for students to develop their leadership skills by being involved in social action on some very important issues and being involved in community service. One of the Y programs going on this week is called Dump and Run. It's a huge recycling program where instead of those things from people's apartments and homes being put out on the street to be carried off to the dump, some which are usable are collected by the Y. And we're collecting again this week, starting tomorrow, August 2nd. And any time from 9 in the morning to 3:30 in the afternoon, you may bring... Anybody listening can bring by things that someone else might appreciate. Household goods, furniture, we even accept cars. And you can stop by the Y at 1001 South Wright Street, come around back where we have a parking lot, and we're loading now our fourth semi-trailer truck for the summer of things that students have left or have donated and other people have donated. We'll be having a huge sale later in August, the first week of school, and August 25, 26, 27 and 28, 4 days at the Stock Pavilion at the U of I. Our sale has outgrown the Y building, even though we have a large building, and it's going to be in the Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue, those dates. So, some great bargains can be found, but this week, Monday through Saturday, you may bring things to the Y between 9 and 3:30. If they're valuable things, we'll write you a note saying you donated them to a charity, and you can take the value of them off on your taxes. Let's see. Coming up this week on AM 580, on Focus 580, at 11 o'clock on Monday, David Inge's guest is Betsy Leander Wright. She's a communications director for United for a Fair Economy, and his guest, a second guest, is Jim Lardner, who's founder of Inequality.org. The topic they're discussing is wealth inequality in America, and because of its obvious ethical issue, I wanted to highlight that for listeners to Keeping the Faith. That's Monday at 11 on Focus 580 here on WILL. Coming up on Friday of this week, August 6, from noon to 1 p.m., there will be a vigil in memory of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan, back on August 6, 1945. This is being sponsored by the Friends Meeting in Champaign-Urbana, but it's open to any other faith-based groups as well as community members who might wish to participate, remembering the deaths of 100,000 people who died as a result of that bombing. The vigil will bring attention to the dangers of nuclear weapons, which continue to proliferate, and the vigil will be promoting the active role of the U.S. in international efforts to reduce nuclear weapons. That's at the Alma Mater at the University of Illinois campus in Champaign-Urbana, August 6, from noon to 1 p.m. Well, let's go to our phones again. We have a caller who's been patiently waiting on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi, it's me again. And I wanted to ask, what did they teach in divinity school?
That's a very
I know that they teach you how to read books, but what do they teach? Since I'm talking to pastors, and this program is called Keeping the Faith, I was baptized and married, and I hope to be buried in the church, and I'll hang up to listen to your answers. Thank you.
So what actually is taught at Princeton Theological Seminary?
Let's see. Biblical studies, theology, pastoral care. I didn't do very well in pastoral care. And what else?
Oh, church history, probably.
Church history. Mm-hmm,
would be another big category. And then there'd be some sort of practical things like preaching, and I guess pastoral care might fall mm-hmm. under that.
At Princeton, everyone had to take speech.
Huh.
And
okay.
Practice baptizing that baby.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, let's look at some of those. In biblical studies, one of the things I remember from my seminary days was how startled I was at how controversial certain parts of the Bible had been for centuries and how many different opinions there were about it. And I knew nothing about that because I'd only heard one opinion, which was what the pastor where my folks went to church had been preaching. And I thought, oh, well, that's the way you think about this. But suddenly there was this whole variety of ways that things can be understood.
And everybody's still very excited about it, vehement opinions on both sides, several sides.
Now, in your seminary, you were required to learn the ancient languages in which the Bible was written.
Yes, we took Hebrew and Greek.
And so you would be expected to be able to read those languages as in the original, as well as through English translations. I never was very good at that. In fact, I failed Greek, if we're going to be honest here to our listeners. The first time I took it, I failed Greek absolutely flat. I thought I was going to have to drop out of seminary.
Oh, no.
And my good spouse encouraged me to be brave and try again. And so I took it in the summer
mm-hmm.
when I could just focus on it. And I managed to get through, but I was not a Greek scholar. I did better with Hebrew, actually. My mind somehow works maybe right to left. I don't know. So biblical studies are one of the things. And some people really think that ministers have not done a good job in sharing what they learned and how to understand the Bible with the congregation. Do you think congregations can accept a pastor who uses literary techniques and real history to interpret the Bible?
Well, my experience has been yes, that people are looking for. It's not a book that you open up and it just immediately makes sense. And there's, isn't there some kind of doctrine that it's just the plain truth or the plain sense? Where did that come from? I've forgotten. But that everyone can just open it up and look at it. And everyone could just open it up and look at it, but they would need to know something about it.
They can sure get some weird things from it.
Yes.
You mentioned, for example, this morning that you preached on Hosea, and you mentioned that here is this ancient prophet who was writing poetry and knew he was writing poetry. He chose that form. Why would a prophet write poetry? I mean, you have to think about that if you're going to interpret it. Now, when you talked about that this morning, you described it as a wonderful poem. Could the people get a sense of that from your enthusiasm? Is that part of your hope that they'll read it themselves and say, gee, Cindy really liked this. Maybe I should think about it again.
Yes. Hmm. Yes, I think you do want that to happen. You hope that that happens. You hope that you're equipping people to do that, to be able to look at the Bible and appreciate it and have it speak to them. One of the things that we're not making arguments, and when we act as poets, we're not making arguments, and we're not trying to tell people how to make up their minds. And I think so many theological arguments and arguments about the Bible, especially, are about what you can know and how things are known. But it's not an argument for the mind. It's an appeal to the soul.
So a sermon is not so much a essay that's trying to persuade someone to change their mind.
Or change their behavior.
Uh-huh.
It's a way to help them see who they are in God, the way God sees them, hopefully. You want them to see themselves with a different perspective.
So in this seminar that's trying to help pastors be better writers, do you write your sermons out? Do you read them word for word? Do you make an outline and then
I've done it all different ways.
Okay.
I'm better if I've written it all out.
Uh-huh.
And I usually have a manuscript with me and I don't read it word for word, but it's kind of like a security blanket.
Hmm.
And some people preach really well from notes. I'm more of a writer than I am a speaker,
mm-hmm.
I think. Hmm. And so I usually write it out. I've written it out. I've done outlines, and I have written it out completely and forgotten it, left it someplace else. That's the only time I preach completely without notes.
So is there a Princeton Theological Seminary style of preaching?
Well, when I went there, you wrote it out.
Okay.
You wrote it out. You have a lot of emphasis on the written word and respect for the craft of writing.
Mm-hmm. And is there a length of sermon that's typical of Princeton graduates? I mean, do Princeton folks preach longer?
No.
No. Shorter?
Princeton's 20 to 25 minutes.
Okay. All right. Professors often, when they're asked to give a sermon, sometimes that happens, and they just don't know where to start because they're used to that 50 minutes at least, or an hour and a half before they can really get into something. Do you find it limiting to have that, a time limit like that where you really can't go longer than 20 or 25 at the absolute max?
I would think if I had to have 50 minutes, and I know some preachers that preach for 40 or 50 minutes, that would paralyze me. That's such a long time.
Okay. So you like that limitation?
I can almost deal with 20 minutes.
Okay. All right. Tell us, you start with this text. You've picked out Hosea. Now, how did you decide to give people little pieces of rope to hold in their hands?
Because I looked at that verse that says about the cords of human kindness, and we don't have our children on leashes. It doesn't really fit with the rest of the passage where the God's people are seen as a child. But then I started thinking about all the expressions about our connections to one another or our connection to God that are leash or rope or string, hanging by a thread, the ball and chain, cutting the apron strings. There are a lot of expressions about our connections, and some connections can get too tight. A connection can lead us in the wrong direction, or a connection could unravel and come apart, and that's also a fear, I think, of people. So I just started playing with that and thinking about what Hosea was saying about our connection to God in light of that rope. What kind of a rope does God have us on? What does it stretch? It stretches. Does it break? It doesn't break.
But here you're taking a writer, a prophet, a poet, that was writing in such a different time, you know, in the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Bible, hundreds of years before the time of Jesus, 2,500 years or more from our time. Why did you think that image would connect with people today?
Because it's a human. I think that's what makes Hosea a major poet, is that he talks about the timeless, eternal truths of human existence. And so that image, I find that image timeless. And I think because it was reflected in so many expressions and contemporary expressions, I was encouraged that that might be a good way to go.
Now, you're a contemporary person. You've had a modern education, good schools, state university, private seminary. You're well educated. You're a person who's aware of what's going on in the world. And yet, here you are dealing with these ancient texts. And do you ever think, boy, one's going to come up some Sunday that isn't going to make any sense to me or anybody else?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do then?
It's a big Bible. Find another one.
Okay. Do you ever preach topically?
No, I'm not sure I do topically.
Okay. You don't just pick a topic and then try to find scripture?
No, we're going to have a series on anger, so we're going to... No, I've never done that.
Okay.
I've never done that.
Why?
I don't trust myself to... When I'm going to go in and pick the text, and I don't have a, no, I don't trust myself to be honest about what the Bible's saying. There's a real temptation to make the Bible say what you want it to say. You can find that's proof texting. You can go in the Bible and you can find pretty much anything there if you're willing to look hard enough and twist it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so, no, I haven't ever done that.
You say you don't trust yourself, but aren't ministers perfect?
No. That's the short answer.
But some